You gals have had a heavy dose of Hendrix this week. And the fact that you have come for another one of a different flavor honors me greatly, and I want you to know that I do not take it for granted. And I have been in places where, when I am introduced as the wife of Howard Hendrix, there are a few feminists in the audience who say, "Oh dear, what a shame, always having to be, you know, the wife of." Well, you heard my husband and what he said about me. And as I've said to some of you personally, he gets carried away. But that's his personality. And I love him for it. And I, although it embarrasses me to death, and it raises the expectation level of you people who think, you know, you're going to get somebody equally as dynamic as the husband and so forth, nevertheless, I am so grateful, and I want to say publicly how grateful I am to be the wife of Howard Hendrix, because it has been, and next Saturday it will be 28 years since we promised to live with each other under the Lord's command. And it has been tremendous. But the thing that gets me is, okay, it's tremendous, but you know the principle, to whom much hath been given, of him much shall be required. And so I have a healthy fear and sort of a scariness that pervades my life, knowing that I have much to give to the Lord when I see him, because I have a lot to answer for. To orient you to my thinking, I want to refer to those little concentric circles that my husband has shown this morning and last night. You will recall that this was a series of circles, and in the center was Christ. And the next circle out was you as a person. The relationship of Christ depends on the quality of you as a person. And then from then on, your partnership, your parenthood, and your ministry. And I want to talk specifically about that inner circle of the person. And in so doing, I have chosen to renew acquaintances with two old friends of ours in the scripture, Mary and Martha. Most of you know them. And you will recall that there is a triad. There are three vignettes given in Luke 10 and John 11 and John 12, where Christ intersects these two lives, these two women. And as I have studied this, and every time I go over it again, I find something new. I am simply thrilled to see how Christ relates to women. I've deliberately chosen this because you have heard the wife angle, the mother angle, very heavily. And that's good. We need that. But we also need to remember that the Lord relates to us as individuals. And we can never gain merit from our husband's spirituality, from his knowledge of the scriptures, from his ministry. The Lord has given to us a function that is distinctive as women, and he relates to us individually. Turn to Luke, the 10th chapter. This is a chapter that is very critical, as they all are in the scripture. But in the first part, you may recall that Christ has sent forth the 70 to preach. And when they came back, they related to the Lord all of the great things that had happened. It says, with joy. And you will recall that it says, Jesus rejoiced in the Spirit. He was happy for them. Just think, his disciples had gone out and had communicated, and it had been so successful. And he gives this prayer to the Father, thanking the Father that he has revealed to these babes these profound truths. And that's what you and I are, you know, the babes. And isn't it tremendous to have the Lord allows us at times to go out and share and with joy bring back the harvest, as it were. And then after this occasion, you have the little dialogue with the lawyer who comes to Christ and says, "What can I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus responds with the familiar passage that we refer to as the parable of the Good Samaritan. And then on the heels of that, Luke moves the scene and says, "And as they went," this is Jesus and his disciples, "he entered into a certain village." Now this village was, of course, the home of Mary and Martha, Bethany. It was about 15 furlongs from the city of Jerusalem. That is about a mile and four-fifths, kind of out in the suburbs. And remember that he, of course, in his infinite wisdom, chose the places where they stopped, the people to whom he was going to minister. And it's a beautiful domestic scene, and each of us can identify with it. Christ comes into this home. Now remember, Christ had this entourage of men with him. When we read this and we think of Christ sitting there, it's not just one man probably that was in the home. Either some or all of his disciples may well have been with him. And he enters into the home, and if I may just read a few of those verses to refresh your memory, in verse 38 of Luke 10, came to pass, as they went, he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. Martha, her house, she was the official hostess, probably the older of the two sisters who lived here. Verbal, in fact, loquacious, extrovertish, hospitable, a very gracious woman, but a very activist type. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha, first I want to talk to you about Martha, was cumbered about much serving, and came to him and said, "Lord, dost thou not care that my sister hath left me to serve alone? Bid her, therefore, that she help me." Now, you see the picture very clearly. These men have come to dinner, and Martha is the responsible hostess in the occasion. Now, all of you probably have had hostessing responsibilities, and I remember as a kid when I used to hear this story in Sunday school, it was very cut and dried. Martha was the bad one, and Mary was the good one. Martha was serving when she should have been listening, and there was Mary doing what she should have been doing, studying the Bible, studying the Word, and left it there. Be a Mary, don't be a Martha. Well, I began to study this on my own, and I realized that it wasn't quite like that. Just growing up helped me to understand a little bit, because somebody had to serve those men. This was a ministry in itself. And you have had, undoubtedly, guests come into your home. Now remember that Mary and Martha were better off economically than many of the people in their culture, and they probably had servants. But as Marge so beautifully shared, having servants is sometimes more complicated than doing it yourself. It requires a lot of supervision and organizational skill and watch care over the whole thing. And so Martha was getting a bit fluttery. She had a lot to do in a short period of time. And her frustration level was rising and rising and rising until finally she exploded. Now, before you get too hard on Martha, think back on some of your own experiences. If I may relate one of my own, just to show you how very human I am. Some years ago, on Thanksgiving, we invited, as was our custom, a group of students. But we lived at that time in a small house, and the kitchen particularly was limited in its facilities. And I had, as I recall, 11 guests that day. And at this particular moment, all of the guests and family were in the living dining room area, and I had closed the door and was in the kitchen. You know those last hectic few minutes right before you get it on the table? I was getting the turkey out of the oven and trying to move the turkey out of the pan so I could make the gravy. But I, as I said, was limited in facilities, and I didn't have the proper space. And as I was lifting the turkey out of the pan, it slipped to where I wanted it to go, and I dropped the turkey on the floor. And quick as a wink, thankful that nobody was in the kitchen at the moment, I picked the turkey up and put it on the platter and thought, I'm sorry, people, but it has to be that way. And grabbed some newspaper and threw it over all the grease and stuff on the floor because I had no time to clean the floor at that moment. But that was, to me, the straw that broke the camel's back. And in that moment of weakness, I went into the little hallway that used to go down past the bathroom in that house, and I slumped against the wall and I started crying like a baby. And I said to the Lord, Lord, you knew this was going to happen. I prayed to you many times about the facilities in this place, and look at it. And I really felt that I had come to the end of my wits. And then I guess all of my whole being and background came, and I thought, oh my word, suppose somebody would walk down the hall looking for the bathroom or something and see their hostess and the professor's wife leaning against the hall like some school child crying. So I said to myself, okay, you can cry later, just get back in the kitchen right now, which I did, and finished up the meal and served it, and it turned out to be one of the best Thanksgivings we ever had. But I'll never forget that experience, and it has colored my whole opinion of Martha, because I know how she must have felt. And she came at that moment of frustration, bursting into the quarters, wherever it was that Christ was being entertained, and she said, Lord, don't you care? That's exactly what I had said to him. Lord, don't you care this mess that I'm in? That's exactly what the disciples said out in the middle of the storm in this Lake of Galilee, I think how I referred to it this morning, when they said, Lord, don't you care that we are perishing? Now, obviously, that's a terrible affront to the Savior. He had said to those disciples, we're going across the lake. We're not going out to drown in the middle. We're going across. But they forgot that. The whole day of lessons that they had on faith just sort of evaporated. Same with myself. I knew the Lord was going to take me through that difficulty. How many times have I told everybody else, He sees you through all the difficulties? But in that moment of weakness, I forgot all of that, and I felt resentful. And I was saying to the Lord, in effect, don't you care this mess that I'm in? And that's what Martha said, don't you care? She said, of course, she turned her wrath from the Lord a little bit and focused it on her sister. Now, if you have a sister or you have girls, this is so typical. You know, you get the older sister particularly, you get into a tight spot and immediately, where is that lazy lout of a sister of mine? She's supposed to be here and she's always goofing off. And I know that I have two girls and my older gal has said things like that to me. There's a resentment. And so this is what Martha said to Christ. She said, Lord, there she is sitting listening to you and here I am. Now look at how many times she uses that personal pronoun, will you? Lord, dost not care that my sister hath left me to serve alone? Bid her therefore that she help me. See, I'm the one, Lord. I'm the one who's important here, Lord. Remember that. I'm the one that's feeding you. Of course, she was all off base, but this was her mentality at the moment. And she was saying to the Lord, she'll listen to you. You tell her to get out here and help me. Well, the Lord gives a very significant, everything he says, of course, is significant, but this is particularly applicable to you and me, I believe. In the first place, cumbered, the word cumbered means literally distracted, pulled apart. This was her, Martha's mental state. And Jesus answered her and said unto her, Martha, Martha, using that double name that he so often used for very special occasions. to really get her attention. Thou art anxious and troubled about many things. Will you please notice that he did not tell her that she was doing the wrong thing? She was completely in the will of God serving that meal. There was nothing wrong with what she was doing, but it was her attitude with which she was doing it. You're anxious, you're troubled about many things. You are coming apart at the seams, Martha. But one thing is needful. Does this ring a bell with you? One thing? I think I made reference to the fact that Paul said, this one thing I do. Remember when the rich young ruler came to Christ and he said, one thing thou lackest? Christ zeroes in on the very most important thing that's wrong here. There were many things that he could have said. You've got a wrong attitude toward your sister. You're off base in many ways, Martha. But he, as he always does, just zeroed in to the very most crucial area in Martha's life. And he said, you're anxious and you're troubled about many things, but one thing is needful. And I want to point you to that thing. And it must have been a little hard for Martha to choke down when he said, Mary, this sister of yours that you're complaining about has chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her. Mary had chosen the permanent, whereas Martha was diddling away on the temporary. Now, again, I emphasize, she was not doing the wrong thing, but she was doing it in the flesh. And you can be doing the right thing, but if you're doing it in the flesh, it's useless. It's going to burn up like wood, hay, and stubble. And we know this, but I think that we need to be reminded of it. I'd like to just, in passing, make one other comment on what Mary was doing, sitting at the feet of Christ, listening to his words. You know, the Lord said in John 6:68, the words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. If I may give a word of admonishment, don't ever think that whatever your husband learns and studies out of the word is going to suffice for you. Oh yes, you'll learn from your husband. I have learned much, much, much from listening to my husband. But I have to get into the word for myself. And it does not matter whether I have 4 children or 40 people in a discipleship. We should never have that many discipleship. I mean, if you have a group that you are ministering to, no matter what your particular responsibility is at the moment, there is no substitute for getting into the Word and letting the Holy Spirit teach you yourself. And so don't ever say, we can never say, well, I'm a mother and I really don't have time to study the Word, because that is never good enough. And our spiritual success, if I may call it that, is in direct proportion to how much we allow the Word to cleanse our lives. So Mary had chosen the better part, and Martha needed to learn that. Now let's see how much she learned. Let's turn over to John 11, and the whole setting here is different, because this is seeing Christ not as a guest in the home, per se, but as a counselor in a crisis situation. And we do not have time to go into the background of this. Most of you are familiar with it. But as Buzzy mentioned before, we do want to have time for questions at the end of this, so I'm going to hurry through. But a couple of things that I think are most significant. In 11:1, notice that it is now called the town of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary has taken a jump in importance, and the town is known as Mary's town. Of course, this was written after the third event when she poured the ointment on Christ. She became famous for that. But Jesus, after the time had elapsed and according to his own perfect will, he came and again intersected the lives of Mary and Martha. In true Martha fashion, she heard he was coming, she took the initiative, and she went bounding out to greet Christ. And she said to him, Lord, if you had been here, our brother had not died. And therein begins a little dialogue that is extremely interesting. And Jesus talks to her and says, thy brother shall rise again. And you'll notice that I did skip 22, where she says, I know now that even God's will be done. He says, thy brother shall rise again. Yes, she says, I know that. I know that he's going to rise again. The resurrection, I've been taught that. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And he that liveth and believeth on me shall never die. Those are powerful words. Do you believe this? What did Martha say? Well, Lord, yes, I believe that you're the Son of God that's coming into the world. She had a general faith, but she did not believe specifically that in this crisis the Lord was going to meet her specific need. And this is pointed out again at the end of the chapter when, again, Martha interjects her erratic statement when, you know, the Lord goes over to the grave. And it's most out of place that she says, oh, Lord, he's been in there 4 days. He's decaying, you know, as if the Lord didn't know that. And again, he talks to her. You see, he's responding to her in kind. She is the verbal type. She needs that dialogue. And you counsel people, take a note as the way the Lord counseled people, because I think this is a great model. He relates to these two individuals on their level according to their temperament. And Martha's the talkative type. She's got to talk back and forth. And Christ talks back and forth with her. And he said in verse 40, when he responds to Martha, he said, Jesus said unto her, didn't I tell you, Martha, said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou should see the glory of God. What a lesson here for us, that in the hour of crisis, that God's grace and God's power is specific for us. It's not just a general faith, but it is in our time of need very, very specific. It's not general. Now notice how he responded to Martha, to Mary. She's weeping. She doesn't even go out when she hears that Jesus is coming. And but what happens in 32, when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet. The second time Mary is at his feet. You've probably seen this before in this first little story in the house. She sat at his feet and heard his word. In the second story, she fell at his feet. In the third one that we're going to see, she washed his feet with her hair. She was always at his feet. And she very interestingly says the same thing that Martha said. Lord, if thou hadst been here, our brother wouldn't have died. It's very interesting. I think they had said that to each other before because they both said it to Christ. But notice how differently the Lord responds to Mary. He didn't give her any theological discourse at all. He looked at her with a comprehension of where she was emotionally. And what did he see? When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also, he groaned in his spirit and was troubled. And he asked, where have you laid? They laid him? And then you know that he wept. Now Jesus Christ was no weakling. We all know that. He was a strong and virile man. And what happens when most men see a woman crying? Well, you know what they do. Oh, honey, stop crying. Just stop crying. You know, anything to get you to stop. Or remember Hannah back in 1 Samuel? Her husband Elkanah said to her, why are you crying? I'm better to you than 10 sons. He just couldn't get this through his masculine brain as to why she would be crying. But Jesus Christ saw Mary. He knew her, and he related to her, and he did not say a word to her. He wept with her. He gave her emotionally what she needed. I think this is the most beautiful picture of counseling. He met her need right there. And of course, then he performed the tremendous miracle of raising Lazarus from the dead. But in this process, notice how Mary and Martha have grown. And I might mention that we can't grow unless we go through these crisis experiences. We do not know how great Christ is, how well he can relate to our problems, unless we go through these deep and dark places with him. And I could illustrate that by many, but I will not take the time. Let's move on to John 12. Here they're having a feast. Lazarus has been raised from the dead, and he's kind of a spectacle in the community now. You know, everybody wants to take a look at him and see this man that was raised from the dead. I recall so well hearing Elizabeth Elliot speak, and she related of how her second husband, Dr. Addison Leach, who passed away over a year ago of cancer, somehow they both expected very much that God was going to raise him up miraculously from this dread disease. Everybody at the school thought that the Lord was going to do this. And she said that Dr. Leach said to her, "Oh, honey, I don't know what I'd do if he delivered me suddenly from this cancer. I would feel like Lazarus. Everybody would come up and say, 'I want to touch you. You're as like one come back from the dead.' Imagine how Lazarus must have felt. He must have felt like a real oddball." And I guess that would be typical of Dr. Leach's way of thinking. Of course, the Lord did take Dr. Leach home, and Elizabeth Elliot came through that, the second of husband, of course, that she lost her first husband, as you all know, in the South America, martyred by the Indians there. But the point of it is that coming back from such a close brush with death, and in Lazarus's case, from death itself, made him a very, very unusual person. So when Simon the leper opened his home and had this feast, He had Lazarus there, and he had Jesus Christ there, two very honored guests. But we are interested mostly in Mary and Martha. And I don't know about you, but I'm so delighted that those two words are in there. Martha served. Martha was still serving. This proves to me that she was not out of God's will when she was serving before. But I think by now her attitude had come around to where she was serving with the kind of heart that the Lord wanted her to have. She was serving joyfully, and she probably had a much bigger crowd to handle. But see, this was her gift. She was a hospitable person. She was probably most organized and able. And I am so thankful for those people, those women that can do this, you know, handle a large crowd of people and do it efficiently and do it well. Well, we had a pretty good example a few minutes ago downstairs. Beautifully done. And it does take a lot of organization, a lot of skill to do this. And Martha apparently had it. And we see here two types of temperament. So don't ever feel that Martha was somehow less spiritual than Mary. Martha was simply developing the gift that God had given her. And we should be very thankful for all of the Marthas in our midst. The truth is that we're mostly just a blend. Some of us are a little bit of Martha and a little bit of Mary together. But now look at Mary and how far she has come. She had what was probably part of the family wealth in those days, an alabaster box of ointment, 10.5 ounces. That's quite a bit. And from what the dissenter said, it was worth about 300 denarii, that being each denarii approximately one day's wage. So that is nearly a year's wages. That's a lot of money. And that's what this represented. She broke this, and the other Gospels where this is recorded tell us that she poured it over his head. This was always done to a very, very special honored guest. She poured it over his head, and then she wiped his feet with her hair. And, of course, the earthly-minded men who looked on these, Judas, of course, is quoted here, they said, "Oh boy, what a waste. I mean, here we are sociologically conscious of all of these poor people, and she takes this very expensive thing and wastes it like that." And of course, Christ explained for those who just didn't have the discernment of what was going on. He had told them over and over again he was going to be crucified. He was going to die. And he was on the eve of that right now. And Mary understood. Why? Because she had been listening to the Lord. She knew what was going to happen. And she gave at the right moment all that she had in an act of worship that is truly exemplary for all of us. There are many lessons that we could draw from this about giving our very best to the Lord, about being tuned in to what the Lord has for us to hear, to be aware of what's ahead, in her case, the Lord's death. But the others are all going on their merry way, thinking that things are going to somehow keep on going. But Mary knows that it's not going to be that way. There is going to be a crisis ahead, and in an act of simple and beautiful and profound devotion, she gives her all to him. And I trust that as you study and read this in your own devotional life, you will see the impact of it. I have been, in the last few days, particularly exercised by some of the things that I have read about women in our country. And within the last three, well, just as I was leaving Dallas on Wednesday, I picked up a publication that is a little journal from the Professional Women's Society, and read this little news item about what women in America really want. This was the head of the heads of 15 major women's organizations who attended a national meeting called Speak Out in New York City on April the 9th, and they were sharing what women in America wanted. It says that they shared their organizational strategies and viewpoints and talked on a wide range of issues such as sexual discrimination, racism in education, the media, patriotism, volunteerism, etc. Then it gives two quotes. This is boiling it all down to what women in America want. First of all, said this one woman who was the head of the women's communication outfit, "It bothers us that women in the U.S. labor force today earn only about 60% of the wages paid to men in comparable positions." In other words, we want for women, we want more money. Another one said, "It bothers us that while U.S. women have equal abilities today, that only 99% of newspaper editors, broadcast station managers, etc., are men." In other words, we want more power, we want more prestige. And so boiling it all down, what the women, the supposedly responsible women in America today are saying is, we want money, and we want power, and we want privilege. And that hit me sort of between the eyes as I've been studying this, about what the Lord had been saying to Mary and Martha. Because what he was trying to teach them was so far removed from what we in America are trying to grasp for ourselves today. He was saying, "Hear my word. Serve me with a pure heart," because that's truly what Mary and Martha were doing. They were hearing and listening and really learning his word, and they were serving him with the proper attitude and with the proper heart. And I trust that as you find your own niche, because see, I have this high resentment against setting these blanket rules for what women ought to do. I think that as Christian women, God is going to reveal to each one of us what our particular function is, but that we do it with a willing heart and with a high awareness of his word as it relates to our lives. Now, I'm cutting this right here because I want to give you opportunity to ask questions. A number of you have already asked me questions privately, but I know that there are a lot more because some of you have said that you had them. So I'm going to throw it open, and obviously my husband, I know, in his condensations of what he has said, has raised many, many questions, and perhaps I've raised some that you would like to ask. So please feel free. I do not feel threatened. I may not be able to answer your question, but I will certainly make a stab at it, do what we can. So, what questions do you have that you would like to raise this afternoon? Yes.
on your husband's sheet for it was a marital intimacy checklist. It had numbers on it.
Right, 1 to 7.
There were two things, creativity and recreation.
Right.
And my husband and I were trying to think of what are some ways that we can. Right now, I think we have nothing in creativity and recreation that we share. I just wondered if you had any ways that you and your husband shared any ideas on that.
Yes, on that, in case some of you did not hear, we're talking about that marital checklist that was given out that was actually compiled by the Kleinbells, Dr. and Mrs. Kleinbell. And there are 2 points on there, recreation and creativity. See, we as evangelicals have been notably weak on what you might call the theology of aesthetics. We are very strong on the exposition of the word and on functional utilitarian values. But when it comes to some of the aesthetic parts of life, we're a little bit weak. And we find that we ourselves have really had to work on this because we do need recreation in our lives. We need a change of pace. We need a time when we get away from the thing that we do regularly in order to refresh ourselves. And this is biblical. You know, the Lord said to his disciples, come apart and rest a while. We need this, and it is absolutely legitimate. So it depends on where you are and what your particular bent is. For us, a good recreation time that we just thoroughly enjoy is coming to the mountains of Colorado. Now, we didn't come for recreation this time, but we do have some time set aside in August that we are going to walk in the mountains. We do a lot of walking ourselves because we just personally enjoy that, and it's good for us physically. And it seems to fit in. It's not something that you have to structure. You don't have to make an appointment, you know, at the bowling alley or something. It doesn't require anything except a pair of walking shoes. And we find that we can sandwich it in whenever there is time. So we are hikers and walkers and occasionally campers because we do enjoy the outdoors and we feel that we do not begin to know enough about God's nature. So this is something that we have done. But I might add that we personally feel that we need to develop more recreational activities. Now that we're older and our lives are not built around the children recreationally, we personally want to develop some more skills on our own. And we're toying with the idea of taking up cross-country skiing next winter. I don't know if that will come about, but this is something that we have sort of planned. Creatively, this keeps life fresh. Creativity in everything you do. And my husband, bless his heart, is a creative person, and he will not allow anybody, whether he's a student or a family member or friend, or he always asks those embarrassing questions about how can you do it better, how can you do it differently, where you just about settle down comfortably in the way you do something, and he's always asking one of those questions about, well, couldn't we do it a little differently next time? And what's the matter, honey? Don't you like? No, I love it, but we just don't ever want to get into a rut. And that's great, and it's so good that the Lord has given me a man like that. But this is what we mean by creativity. You don't ever get into a rut when you're constantly thinking of a new twist, a new way to do whatever you do. If it's serving breakfast, to entertaining your friends, to the way you dress, to any part of your lifestyle or your ministry, you can always do it better, a different way. Turn it around in your mind. How can I do this just a shade different? This makes you an interesting person. It makes you a sought-after person. And it keeps you fresh. It keeps you young. So I don't know if that completely answers your question, but that's sort of what the idea of it is. Yes?
One of the things you mentioned last night was creating a love to work.
Well, I think that part of his own love for work, of course, as he indicated, came from it's being caught by it being in a family where everybody works and everybody loves to work. But the way you love to work, again, is an attitude. And, of course, this was illustrated in Martha today. I don't think she loved that first time in Luke. You know, she was under the gun there when she was trying to serve everybody. But I think she enjoyed the John 12 serving because it is an attitude. And if you, as a mother, are forever making those little comments, well, I guess I got to get with it, and, honey, would you please do that for me? You know, in other words, I just hate to do that. It's amazing how these little innuendos infect the family so that work becomes a chore. I mean, truly a burdensome thing. However, if you as a family, and it really is best done as a team, get into a project and say, you know, we're going to just say clean the house. If you organize it, and sometimes it means that you make little promises for the end, you know, when we get through, we're going on a picnic, something special, you lighten it and you have that expectation that this is a means to an end. Furthermore, it becomes a habit pattern in your life. I learned this from my European friends, or I should say it was reinforced by my European friends, the absolute spotlessness, especially in the Netherlands. You know, you never see a dirty house over there, and nobody complains about cleaning. Maybe they do behind the scenes, I don't know. But it seemed like everybody just loved to keep things clean, and just always did. And it lightens the whole way of living, and it makes you feel so much better. But cleaning is only one thing. I mean, there are many, many other chores, and some of them are kind of drudgery. But it is certainly our attitude toward it, and I think when we see it as a means to an end, not an end in itself, that it takes on meaning. And then, of course, the higher dimension as Christians, that we work, everything we do heartily is unto the Lord. You know, when you as a housewife really get this, that I am scrubbing this pan because I want my pans to shine for the glory of the Lord. That sounds a little corny, but I mean, really, that is sort of the way it is. I feel that I have a lot of student wives who come into my house, and I don't really mind using that Brillo pad on some of my pans because I know that they're going to be on display. And I like my pans to look shiny. I don't like those black marks on there. And so this gives me that initiative and that incentive to really clean them up. Or I like my house to be cleaner. I like my children to be well-behaved. And so this is an incentive to sit down and really work on some of those more difficult things. Yes, Betty. My favorite method of personal Bible study. My favorite is to do it early in the morning. This is not always possible, but it is more than it used to be. Usually, I like, and this time-wise, I like to do it after my husband has gone to the office, and I am fresh. Before I get into the regular chores of the day, I like to spend my time studying the Word. Now, personally, I have learned how very important the Gospels are. And so I usually study a book at a time, and I will study Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and I take turns with them and intersperse them with another book of the Bible. Like right now, I'm in 1 Samuel again, which is one of my favorites. But then when I get back, I get through from 1 Samuel, I'll jump back into the Gospels and think I'm back to Matthew again this time. But I take it usually sort of a paragraph at a time. I must explain that there's always a class or a group that I'm preparing for, and this is different from my own personal Bible study. I feel that the Lord gives me a lot of food when I just can study a passage and apply it to my own life, my own special personal needs. And I don't always take very much. Sometimes it's only like a couple of verses, and I just really chew on that and use sometimes, of course, other helpful commentaries if need be. But I I do what I think my own special spiritual need is for that particular day, that particular time. And it's amazing how often the Lord correlates what I'm studying with a verse that I'm memorizing for that day, or with something I'm teaching with a group. He brings it all together, and it is just absolutely fantastic. So, yes. Yes, she's asking about the Equal Rights Amendment, and I wish that I were really more knowledgeable on this. As you know, it has been a very controversial issue. It is in Texas right now. And I really don't know, as I say, enough to speak, but I will tell you my views, limited as they are. When the original amendment was passed, and I can't think of the number of it, but that gave equal rights to everybody, this set us, I think, legally in a place where we needed to be, and that is that there would be no discrimination, race, sex, or otherwise, in our nation when it came to jobs and pay and so forth. But now, apparently, there seems to be on the part of many that they want an emphasis for sort of an interchangeable situation, as I understand it, with men and women. And those who are pro-ERA say, now stop worrying, it isn't going to mean that we're going to have no men's and women's restrooms. It isn't going to mean necessarily that we're going to induct all of the girls into the army. But one of the catches in this thing is that this is subject to the various Congresses, which happen to be in session, and they can be interpreted. It's not a hard and fast thing, but it will be allowed to be interpreted by the men who are then in office. And this could mean anything. I mean, it could just go in any direction. And I personally feel that it's not good. Realistically, we may just be a matter of time before the whole thing is ratified and we're living under it. And if so, God will give us grace. But I certainly would not vote for the ERA as I see it at this time. Yes?
Your husband was talking about a wife not having a ministry outside the home.
Yes.
I was wondering, is he in that no ministry at all, or just no ministry that takes place in the family?
Thank you for asking the question, because I think I didn't hear the tape, but apparently my husband said, at least gave the impression, that when our children were younger, I had no ministry at all. And that was not the intent of his statement. I think what he meant to say was I did not have a regular, sort of a full-time thing. Now, there are several things that I'd like to say on this subject. First of all, every one of us is different. And some girls and some navigator wives whom I know seem to be able to do a full-time ministry, raise their families, take care of their husbands, everything just so efficiently, and I take my hat off to them and I say, more power to you. But I think the basic to this whole thing is that we have to evaluate our own limitations. I talked with a girl in another Christian organization just a couple months ago who was just about ready to quit, and her husband has a very responsible job. But she has 3 small children, and her husband is expecting her to just be with him almost every night of the week, and she's just dragging. She said, I just can't make it, and I don't want to be unspiritual. Well, of course not, but at this period in her life, she needs to be putting the emphasis on her children, and she herself does not have that kind of stamina to carry on both. So she needs to be realistic and honest about it and say, honey, I can't do that. Now, he should be perceptive enough, but he's not. Some husbands need to be reminded, and that's all right. But you need to evaluate yourself, and may I say emphatically that I do not believe that you need to feel guilty. Your conscience, number one, needs to be clear before the Lord. Now, if you're using your children, your home as a cop-out, then your conscience better not be clear. It can't be. because God has called you to give your utmost to Him. He wants to be Lord of your life, and He wants to invade every area of your life, and He wants to develop every gift that you have. But it will not always be the same. And when He sends little children into your lives, very often you have to say no to a lot of outside ministry that you might want to do. But again, I say, don't let it be a cop-out. Now, for me personally, I always had to have something going beside my family. I always taught a Sunday school class or vacation Bible school or was active in the women's work at our church or was doing some, at least some writing at home. Always something going because that was, I sort of needed that balance. And I might also admit to you that I have a hard time saying no. I tend to get in over my head. You may not know people like that, but I'm one of them. And I had to sometimes admit to the Lord that I was doing too much. And therefore the quality of what I was doing sometimes wasn't too great. And then the Lord, and this is what really I think got through to my husband more than anything else. I came to a place where I was doing too much outside, and I became very verbal about it because I wanted to establish in my children, my husband, myself, before the Lord, that my children were really, truly my primary discipleship group. It hit me that I had four children, and these are the ones who are going to live after me, and I am responsible to the Lord for them as my own primary disciples. And I really, truly felt that to the bottom of my feet. And we live in a sort of a sheltered atmosphere right now. You know, it's sort of a time of peace and plenty. And it's not always going to be this way. We know it. We just don't know how long before the hard times are going to come, before the Lord allows us to suffer in one way or the other. And we need to prepare our children. And if we do not spend time with them and prepare them, then they are going to be unprepared. So I feel very strongly that we have this strong responsibility to our children. And I really try to fulfill this in my own family. Now, let me add a footnote. Some people have said, well, in light of the terrible days in which we live, why do we have children at all? And, of course, my husband spoke to this somewhat last night. But remember this, that times were never worse to bring a child into the world than when Jesus Christ was born. We are not yet facing the time when they're slaughtering the babies. But irrespective of what government is in power, when God is in control of our families, He's going to take care of them, and He's going to give us the grace to go through with whatever situation He brings about. He is in control, and that is the main thing that keeps us stable, keeps us going, keeps us entrusting our children to Him. You know, a lot of people live today as if there were no tomorrow. They say, well, I mean, Christians, the Lord's coming, you know, well, we don't want to have any family. That is false. He is coming at any moment, but we live preparing for tomorrow and getting those children ready to carry on if the Lord should tarry. That's a very sobering thought, but it's something that I think we as mothers have to face and face realistically. Now, our time is up, and I regret that it is, but I do thank you so much for your patience, and want you to know I appreciate so much the fellowship with all of you. Thank you. Thank you.